This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the May 11th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. While U.S.-led NATO forces and Russian forces are engaged in building up their respective militaries on either side of Russia's western border, the ultranationalist fascist forces that were instrumental in the overthrow of Ukraine's elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, in 2014 have been flexing their muscles in Odessa. They have predictably received little attention from the U.S. media, which have downplayed their role in producing the third regime change involving the Obama presidency. Given their position in Ukraine's crumbling economy and the emergence of similar forces across Eastern and Central Europe, the importance of Ukraine's ultra-right should not be ignored or minimized. Today, at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking about that subject and other related issues with Professor Nikolai Petrov from the University of Rhode Island, one of the country's foremost authorities on Russia and Ukraine affairs. Before I get to that, a little refresher on how a 21st century version of the Cold War came to be, which I reported to you back in 2014. It may be helpful. In December 2013, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State for Europe, Victoria Nuland Kagan, spoke to the Ukrainian American Foundation in Washington and boasted that the United States had spent $5.1 billion on its efforts to overthrow the government in Ukraine, although the terms she used were a bit more diplomatic. I played the audio of her speech for you at the time, and you can still find it on YouTube. I also played for you a secretly tape recording of Nuland Kagan and Jeff Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine at the time, discussing who should be the country's prime minister following the coup against Ukraine's elected president, as the two have been openly plotting, aided by the U.S. NGOs on the ground in Kiev. Not surprisingly, following the coup, Nuland Kagan's choice, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, got the job. That audio as well can still be found online. What should be noted is that Nuland Kagan was Hillary Clinton's press spokesperson while the former First Lady was Secretary of State, and should Clinton make it to the White House, it is more than likely she'll be appointed to a high-level foreign policy position. No less important is it that she is married to Robert Kagan, co-founder of the Project for a New American Century, the neocon think tank that brought us the Iraq War and whose attitude towards Russia has not changed since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Robert Kagan has already endorsed Clinton's nomination, and that should really come as no surprise because her foreign policy positions are identical to those of Kagan and most of his fellow neocons. That Clinton would hire Nuland Kagan as her spokesperson and that Obama would later appoint her as his Deputy Secretary of State for Europe and Asia points to how little actual change there has been between the Bush and Obama administrations when it comes to foreign policy. It's important to recall Nuland Kagan's actions in Ukraine now because what it set in motion was the current confrontation between a remilitarized Russia and a re-energized NATO on its borders. This required NATO breaking an oral agreement that had been made with the Russians back in 1990 as part of its agreeing to the reunification of Germany that it would keep its distance from Russia's borders. Washington, as NATO allies, blamed Russia's annexation of Russian-speaking Crimea for today's heightened confrontation and as an excuse for moving its troops eastward, but NATO had in fact broken its word to the Russians 5 years earlier. It's worth mentioning that Crimea had been part of Russia from 1783 to 1954, at which time Ukrainian-born Prime Minister Nikita Khrushchev arbitrarily transferred it over to the Ukrainian Socialist Republic while maintaining it as part of the Soviet Union. This fact was rarely mentioned by Western media. Back in 2009, then-Russian President Dmitry Medvedev had accused the West of breaking its promises regarding respect for Russia's borders. Washington and its NATO allies denied that any commitment had been made regarding the movement of its troops during the critical discussions over German reunification. It was the Russians who were telling the truth, however, as Germany's Der Spiegel magazine revealed, when newly discovered documents in Western archives supported Moscow's position. On February 10th, 1990, Between 4 and 6:30 p.m., Der Spiegel noted, German Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher spoke with his Russian counterpart, Eduard Shevardnadze. According to the German record of the conversation, that had only recently been declassified, Genscher said, quote, "We are aware that NATO membership for unified Germany raises complicated questions. For us, however, one thing is certain, NATO will not expand to the east," end quote. And because the conversation revolved mainly around East Germany, Genscher added explicitly, quote, "As far as the non-expansion of NATO is concerned, this also applies in general," end quote. Shevardnadze replied that he believed, quote, "everything the minister," Genscher, "had said." Moreover, Mikhail Gorbachev claimed that Secretary of State James Baker had made the same commitment to him, and the expansion of NATO violated the spirit of agreements that unfortunately were not put in writing. To bring you up to date, Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said last Wednesday that Russia will deploy 3 divisions of troops along its borders to counter NATO's increasing military presence in Eastern Europe. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of War Ash Carter said last week that NATO is considering stationing a force of around 4,000 troops in Poland and the 3 Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. This would be in addition to another deployment already authorized, the U.S. Armored Brigade, about 4,200 troops that will be sent to Eastern Europe in February. Carter said on Monday that the additional Eastern European force NATO is considering would consist of 4 battalions of soldiers contributed by NATO members on a continuously rotating basis. Meanwhile, in the wars of the Middle East that have no foreseeable end, a note of unwarranted optimism emerged. It was as connected to reality as what those in the mid-1960s heard from U.S. officials concerning the progress of the war on Vietnam. Quote, "So far in terms of what we had hoped to do, we are pretty much on track," said a U.S. official quoted in the Washington Post, who spoke on the condition of anonymity in order to discuss sensitive subjects. "We are actually a little bit ahead of where we wanted to be," he said. However, according to the Post article, quote, "the fight is entering what Pentagon officials have called a new and potentially harder phase, one that will entail a deeper level of U.S. involvement, but also tougher targets." In an attempt to ramp up the tempo of the war, the article goes on, the U.S. military is escalating its engagement, dispatching an additional 450 special operations forces and other troops to Syria and Iraq, deploying hundreds of Marines close to the front lines in Iraq, and bringing Apache attack helicopters and B-52s into service for the air campaign. You remember the B-52s. They were used to bomb Vietnam back to the Stone Age, and they're still around, while the unindicted war criminals who ordered them into the air were allowed to retire or die in peace. Well, the extra resources, the Post article continues, are an acknowledgement, U.S. officials say, that the war can't be won without a greater level of American involvement. The targets that lie ahead are those that are the most important to the militant self-proclaimed caliphate, including their twin capitals of Raqqa in Syria and Mosul in Iraq, and to a lesser extent, Fallujah, a key concern because of its proximity to Baghdad, end quote. Wrong. Fallujah should be a key concern to all Americans because it was a site of the first use by U.S. forces of weapons containing depleted uranium, the first in modern warfare. It devastated the people of that city far more cruelly than ISIS has done, and it was the Democratic Party leadership from the Obama White House to both houses of Congress that allowed the criminals responsible to get away with it. As Dar Jamal reported on Democracy Now 3 years ago, quote, "noting the birth defects in the Iraqi city of Fallujah, they're extremely hard to bear witness to, but it's something that we all need to pay attention to. What this has generated is, from 2004 up to this day," said Jamil, "we are seeing a rate of congenital malformation in the city of Fallujah that has surpassed even that in the wake of the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki that nuclear bombs were dropped on at the end of World War II," end quote. Yes, it was something that we all need to pay attention to, and yet we didn't. Listeners of Sunday's Weekend Edition on NPR, particularly the nearly 500 residents of Mendocino County who showed up at Ukiah's Convention Center Saturday to hear Hawaiian Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard speak on behalf of Bernie Sanders' presidential candidacy, were, I suspect, more than a little miffed. That's when they heard NPR's national correspondent Mara Liasson announce that, despite whatever happens in the remaining primary contest, and even if the party superdelegates vote the way their respective states have done up to now, it is, she said, quote, mathematically impossible for Sanders to get the nomination, unquote. While Senator Sanders' chances of getting the nomination at this point are admittedly slim, Liasson's statement was simply not true. What it reflected, as she demonstrated again yesterday and this morning, chipping in with additional comments denigrating the Sanders candidacy, is the thinly disguised efforts of the media establishment, of which NPR and Liasson are signature members, to snuff out Sanders' historic presidential run and anoint Hillary Clinton as a Democratic nominee and the country's next president. A story in the online journal Political Monday told a different story. It reported that Clinton had resumed running TV ads on the eve of yesterday's West Virginia primary, concluding that, quote, Clinton's campaign is eager to stop Sanders from gaining momentum with a string of victories through May, end quote. I suspect they're even more eager today after Sanders' drubbing of Clinton in the Mountaineer state. What must be worrying her and what might make the superdelegates think twice is that 4 out of 10 Sanders voters in West Virginia said they would support Trump if Clinton is the nominee. One superdelegate, our member of Congress, Jared Huffman, who initially indicated he would be supporting Clinton in Philadelphia, now says that he will vote for whoever has the most delegates coming into the convention. Should Sanders keep winning, particularly in California, it's more likely that other superdelegates will do the same by July's convention in Philadelphia. Despite lobbying efforts by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, it appears that Washington will take a tougher tone with Israel in an upcoming report that takes the Jewish state to task over the expanding of Jewish-only settlements in the West Bank, the resumption of demolitions of Palestinian homes, and the seizures of land belonging to the Palestinians that ostensibly would be theirs in a future state. That's according to 3 unnamed American diplomats who spoke with the Associated Press. The report to be issued by the U.S. and its fellow members of the so-called quartet, the UN, the EU, and Russia and the United States, will also chastise Palestinian leaders for failing to rein in anti-Israeli violence, but the diplomats involved in drafting the document said its primary focus will be the surge of construction in Jewish housing in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. According to the AP, the U.S. approval of the harsh language marks a subtle shift. Washington has traditionally tempered statements by the so-called quartet with careful diplomatic language, but the officials said the U.S. in this case will align itself closer to the positions of the European Union, Russia, and the UN, who have been more critical of Israel's role in the Mideast impasse. While, as the AP notes, the reports released later this month is sure to infuriate Israel, this announcement several weeks in advance seems guaranteed, if not designed, to stimulate Israel's friends in Congress, as well as presumptive presidential candidates Clinton and Trump, to rise in Israel's defense and pressure the State Department to water down the text in alignment with the wishes of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, Israel's domestic lobby. The report will be largely symbolic, requiring no action, but it could be presented to the UN and possibly sent to the Security Council for an endorsement, according to the diplomats. According to the AP, they demanded anonymity because they weren't authorized to discuss the unfinished work publicly. Now, that would seem to be a serious leak of critical information from within the State Department, would it not? But does anyone seriously think the leakers will be hunted down and punished? I don't think so. Now, according to the Israeli paper Haaretz, the quartet's report has largely become a Washington affair, with an American, Frank Lowenstein, taking the lead in drafting it, although U.N. Special Envoy Nikolai Mladenov and EU Envoy Ferdinando Gentilini reportedly were said to have offered suggestions. This week, the quartet delegates are meeting in Moscow to unify the various drafts so as to make the final document ready for the foreign ministers' summit in Paris on May 25th. This presumably gives the members of Congress as well as Clinton and Trump plenty of time to weigh in. Meanwhile, on the eve of the bid to have her church divest from companies allegedly profiting from Israel's control of the West Bank, Clinton has reasserted that the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement targeting Israel's settlement policy is counterproductive to peace. Clinton was responding on Sunday to an appeal from the Israel Action Network, an affiliate of the Jewish Federations of North America, ahead of the quadrennial United Methodist Church General Conference that started yesterday in Portland, Oregon. In a two-page message, Clinton, who was raised and remains a practicing Methodist, did not directly mention the church, but repeated what she had previously told AIPAC's National Convention, quote, that BDS seeks to punish Israel and dictate how the Israelis and Palestinians should resolve the core issues of their conflict, end quote. Meanwhile, in Israel, a portion of Holocaust Remembrance Day speech by one of Israel's highest-ranking officers has caused a furor that has yet to die down. Elements of General Yair Golan's speech drew so much harsh criticism that in some cases it complained, a Jerusalem Post writer, they overshadow the actual meaning of Holocaust Remembrance Day. What did Golan say? He said, quote, "The Holocaust should bring us together and ponder our public lives, and furthermore, it must lead anyone who is capable of taking public responsibility to do so. Because if there is one thing that is scary in remembering the Holocaust, it is noticing horrific processes which develop in Europe, particularly in Germany, 70, 80, and 90 years ago, and finding remnants of that here among us in the year 2016. Under withering criticism, Golan backpedaled, saying that he did not mean to compare Israel or the Israel Defense Forces to the Nazis. Yet the Nazis fall into the time frame he discussed, noted the Jerusalem Post critic. Even accepting his clarification, they wrote, Germany 70, 80, 90 years ago was just too close for comfort to a Nazi comparison for many, especially on Holocaust Remembrance Day when we're mourning the 6 million Jews they murdered, end quote. Golan had one supporter in Environmental Protection Minister Avi Gabay. The Jerusalem Post quoted Gabay as pointing out that Major General Golan has enough perspective to be granted our attention without everyone pouncing on him. The harsh criticism is out of place. There is nothing similar between Israel today and what happened in the Holocaust, but there is definitely the budding signs of nationalism and racism that is reminiscent of Germany in the 20s and 30s, end quote. For anyone who has seen the YouTubes online of crowds of young Israeli men and women shouting death to the Arabs, that can be classified as an understatement. This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.